we have already hammered the title, the theme of I Believe, Help My Unbelief. It comes originally from the Gospels. It was the cry of a desperate man who came to Jesus, and he knew that God was the answer to his problems. He sensed that Jesus Christ was the way to God, in some sense. He knew that faith mattered, but that's as far as he could get. He could only say these words, I believe, but help my unbelief. And we've taken them today as the theme because they're so up to date, although they were uttered so long ago. I suspect that there are many people here tonight and many, many people in the world who have got into this sort of position. Deep down, they sense that there is a God. They feel that Jesus Christ is probably the way to God. But their minds are so filled with doubts and uncertainties that things seem to get stuck there and there's no way forward. So tonight we're going to face this one as honestly as possible and try and see if we can find a way forward from this position of halfway uncertainty. Let's look again at the position because I think we need to see exactly what sort of position it is. It's basically one of sensing there is a God. Now, perhaps some people haven't even got that far here tonight, but I do think that the majority of people in the world still have this basic sense of there being a God. But when we think any further about God, the confusion crowds in on us, and we can't see the way forward. And unbelief clouds this basic deep-down sense that there is a real God. And we can respond to that two ways. We can say, well, this is a fact of life. I sort of believe and sort of don't, and that's how I'm made. Or we can move forward and say, I want to believe. So basically, I'm talking tonight to people who have, in some sense, got an inner conviction that God is and that Christ is in some way the answer. But maybe your doubt is, well, supposing it's just because I've been brought up in a Christian country and I've been inculcated with Christian ideas from school or from my family, and perhaps it's just a cultural hangover. That's why I can't escape this basic of feeling that there is a God. So I do want to look at the ground of why we believe briefly tonight, so we can come to terms with this conviction and see it as something genuine and honest and real, not just something we've picked up because of our background or our education. But secondly, I am speaking basically to people who are willing to move forward from this position of unbelief. But more of this later on. Why do we start with this basic conviction that there is a God? What has brought many of us to this position? I think that subconsciously or even consciously, it's a built-up response to our whole experience of life. That there are many, many things in life and in our own experience and in other people's experience that keep pointing us back to God. As I say, this may be subconscious. We may never even have sat down and worked it out. Or we may have got so far in working it out consciously. Let's have a look at some of the things that drive us as individuals and have driven humanity again and again to belief in God. It is, above all, this sense that behind the world there is personality and not emptiness. That there is purpose and not meaninglessness. And this has probably come through to us, perhaps from looking at creation. We've looked at the world about us. We've seen the pattern of it all, the wonder of it all. This is where we were focusing on the slides. And we have responded, as in one place the Bible points to a response. The heavens are telling the glory of God. We see the hand of God in creation. It was Isaac Newton who argued with an atheist friend of his by producing a model of the universe as it was then understood. And it was a marvelous and intricate thing, and the friend said to Newton, "Who on earth made this?" "Nobody," replied Newton with a twinkle in his eye and rather casually. Oh, that's ridiculous, said the friend. Quite, said Newton. Of course it's been made, but isn't it even more ridiculous that you say the real thing has just happened and not been made by somebody? That conviction has continued to carry weight with thinking people all through the ages. Malcolm Muggeridge, in our own generation, has summarized the argument like this. It is inconceivable that there should be this oneness in creation without a one. And we do see, when we look at creation, that there is a oneness and a purpose and a pattern and a remarkable unity. The way it all slots together, nature is tremendous. And it seems inconceivable that there should be this oneness without a one, says Muggeridge. And I believe many of us acknowledge that that argument carries great weight. But perhaps our observations have gone beyond the impersonal, external world, and we've looked at human beings. And we've begun to see something of what it means when the Bible says man is made in the image of God. And we've begun to see that in man there is some sort of reflection of an intelligent, personal creator. Perhaps we've noticed it in the great sense of right and wrong, which men have everywhere. Very often a perverted sense, and it certainly doesn't work smoothly, but it's there. Isn't it deep down in the human makeup? How quickly we become morally grieved if we feel somebody has done something against us. We see it in children. It's not fair, is one of the commonest responses of children. And how quick they are to get indignant that somebody has taken this or done that to them. And basically, we don't change that much as we become adults. We simply learn to control this sense and not to express it quite so freely. But we rapidly become indignant when we think we have been wronged against. Because we have this incredible sense that right and wrong matter. Certainly they matter to us. And we also feel that they matter in a deeper sense. And that tells us something of the way we're made. Moral beings. Where does this sense of morality come from? It points all the time to a moral creator. Modern psychology has helped us to understand something which the human race has always understood instinctively, that love matters, and that if we are deprived of love at any stage, and particularly in the early stages of our life, we're not the fulfilled and complete human beings we are meant to be. We need love, and we need to be loved. This is how we work as human beings. And this reflection points back to a creator who is love. Another thing we notice in ourselves and in others, again, something which is sometimes very clouded, but there is a great desire to reduce order to chaos. We notice it, as I say, perhaps in our friends, perhaps in ourselves, very often in a rather clouded way, but all of us know the desire to get tidied up. We come in, we see chaos, and we want to reduce it to order, sometimes anyhow. And there's a great sense of satisfaction when we have reduced the chaos, whether it's the untidiness of our flat or our room, to order. And it's the same when it comes to thinking about life. We're presented with a jumbled collection of facts, and instinctively we want to put them together into a pattern. We want to make sense of them. We want to reduce them to order. This is how we're made. This is humanity. And it is a reflection of a creator who brings order to chaos, who brings meaning from a collection of facts. So we see that not only is there a one hauntingly behind creation, but that this one reflected in his creation, especially in man, is moral, is loving, and is a God of order and purpose. Now, as I say, these sort of awarenesses of God may have lain dormant in us, and even as I'm speaking now, some people may be saying, yes, this makes sense. I've never seen it quite so clearly before, but it's beginning to click. Other things make us begin to think and to clarify our picture of God. Very often it's something personal, like meeting somebody who impresses us. I wouldn't be at all surprised if that was true for some of us here tonight in church, that we've met Mary or John or Simon, and there's something about the way they live at work or at college which has caught our attention. they do seem to have a deep sense of purpose, a deep sense of conviction about truth and right and wrong. They do seem to have a peace about their lives and an ability to go on loving and caring, which we have to admit is not natural and common in the people we mix with. They claim that it comes from a relationship and a knowledge of God. And we're wondering whether they're right. Maybe we haven't been fortunate enough to have such a first-hand experience of the power of God in somebody else's life, but we may have read it and been impressed by reading in books. How many of us are impressed by the life story of Gladys Aylward? Or maybe we've seen the film, if not read the book. We've seen her courage, not only in going out to a completely alien country, but getting involved with suffering and going into situations which we would never dare go into. And her explanation every time is that God gave her the courage. God guided her. God saw her through. And as we look at the facts, we're impressed and hard pushed to find an alternative. Or it may be somebody like Kagawa in Japan, whose life of identification with suffering and human need shows the reality of the Christian's claim to be moved and filled with the love of God through knowing God in Jesus Christ. So all these factors have begun to push us more and more deeply into acknowledging that it does make sense that there is a God. I do believe, we're beginning to say, in a half-convinced fashion. And maybe we've even begun to explore a bit further and make some sort of personal response. We may have opened our Bibles up and flicked through the pages of the Bible to see if our faith will spring into life. Maybe it's been challenged, especially if we've come across the Gospels and really gone into the life of Jesus and allowed it to speak to us and his teaching to communicate to us. And yet maybe at the same time we found an awful lot that is confusing. We may have started with Genesis, and immediately doubts have crowded into our minds as to how this fits in with the elementary science which we've picked up at school. Or perhaps our knowledge of science is not so elementary and our problems far more profound. Maybe we've turned on the pages of this history and come to some very bloodthirsty encounters of the Jews, apparently God's chosen people, with other nations. And we're hard-pressed to find the God of love in these accounts. Maybe it's just that as we've read through the Bible, so much of it seems irrelevant to our modern situation. And we're left with a kaleidoscope of indecision as we look first at one thing, then at the other. Maybe we've begun to pray, and in a sense, we feel that prayer has achieved something, and we have gained a certain amount of peace from prayer. But we wouldn't say that it had brought us to know God, or that we normally found that it gave us any great sense of the reality of God. Nor do we find it comes natural to us to pray. So still, the way forward to faith, although half opening up, seems to mock us as we try and press forward. I believe, help my unbelief. Maybe our whole mind is rocking first one way and then the other, as in that slide presentation, one focused first on one set of facts and then on another set of facts. Yes, I see the order of the world and I see it pointing to God, but what about the disorder that there is in the universe? And yet I have to acknowledge that the disorder is not the basic pattern. The basic pattern is order, good. But there is a great amount of disorder and chaos breaking out in it. Why does humanity suffer so much? And then maybe I turn open the Bible and begin to look into some of its arguments, and I see the Bible asks a different question as well. It asks, why does rebellious, self-willed humanity experience so much of the grace and goodness and love of God? I look at these other world faiths and I ask myself, can they really all be wrong? They've endured for so many years. They've got the force of civilizations behind them. And yet when I ask, have they any equivalent of a Christ who comes and speaks the words of God, who lives a life such as he does, who not only dies, but appears to rise again and convince people that he is alive, I see no equivalent in these other religions. And I do see that Christ is unique. But can all my friends be so misguided? They seem to be carrying on quite happily without God. And yet, how seldom we talk deeply. What do they really think about the purpose of life, about life after death, about the meaning of love? Happy enough they may be, but have they really come to grips with the basic issues of life? Or like me, are they still running away? Well, we're well on into the sermon, and already you may be saying, well, this is fine. I follow one argument, you're just beginning to convince me, and you give me another one, and I swing the other way. Must I go on all my life, going first from one extreme to the other? No, there is a way of breakthrough, and I come to that now. I think it is important that we weigh up the basis of our faith. We see why we are moved towards belief in a living God and in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. But all the arguments in the world will only take us so far. And then there must be another way through. And the way through is the way of personal relationship. This argument has been put very clearly by a modern writer, David Edwards, who says this: perhaps we should have preferred a God who uses his power in order to make life perfect for us immediately. But this is not the real God. We meet a God whose wisdom is above us and whose pathway in part perplexes us. A God we understand only by entering into a relationship with him and beginning to share his thinking. And I think as we dwell on that thought, we see that it must be right. How else are we, created beings, to understand our Creator other than in a relationship with him? We can never sit on the outside and judge his world and understand his world and analyze him. We can only come to him and say, Lord, help me understand. Help me to put my thinking together and become real to me in a personal sense. For a personal God will not become real to us in a test tube or on the pages of a textbook, but only in a personal relationship with him. So we see how this must be the point of breakthrough from unbelief to a real committed faith. So this brings us the second challenge. Not only the challenge of moving from the world of uncertainty to increasing conviction, but the second challenge is the challenge of willingness. As we become more convinced of the reality of God, are we willing to be convinced? And here I believe, if we're honest, we're going to hit a great stumbling block. Because if we're honest, I believe that we see that many of our doubts and our uncertainties are deeper than intellectual doubts. They're rooted in pride, in self-confidence of the wrong kind, which makes us more important than others. They're rooted in self-will, which is the enemy of love, and therefore the enemy of God, who is love. They can be summed up in the words of a novel. Pride and prejudice, I believe, are great stumbling blocks to coming to a really committed faith. Let's look at those two. Pride, because it means admitting, some of us for a very long time, that we have been wrong. And none of us find that easy to do. Therefore, we will find ourselves wrestling with our pride as we consider commitment to God. Many of us maybe have not got those years of convictions, which we now begin to see may be wrong, to turn against. But nevertheless, we've got our pride when it comes to going back and telling friends and relatives that we have seen fit to change our way of life that we have come to believe in the living God and commit ourselves to the living God. That is not going to be easy, and we are fearful. Fear, of course, goes hand in hand with pride, as does unwillingness to face up to what may be involved in turning to God, in listening to Him, in taking orders, not in a military sort of way. God is not a military God, but a God who knows what is right, and with all the wisdom and authority and love of a father, He makes clear to us the way that we should take and expects us to take it. And we feel an unwillingness. We're mature human beings. We've grown up. We don't like taking authority. And we feel rebellion mounting in our hearts at the thought of turning to this God who will make demands on us. Is this the root of our unbelief? To what extent is prejudice the root of our unbelief? Prejudice builds up from a mixture of things. It builds up from all that we hear from our friends, all that we watch on the telly, read in books. It is especially true if we've been brought up in a very tight culture, which has inculcated a certain way of thinking and acting into our lives. And as we begin to consider a change in our thinking, we feel prejudice mounting up within us. It cries out, don't change, keep in the rails that you have gone smoothly along so far. You understand this realm. And prejudice cries out, don't believe. Can I illustrate the power of prejudice by a fairly light-hearted illustration? I don't know if you've heard it. It's the story of a man whose problem was that he believed that he was dead. Obviously, it was a psychological problem, and his doctor referred him to a psychiatrist. They went over this again and again and again, but they could find no way to break this deep-seated conviction this man had that he was dead. And the psychiatrist finally believed that he had hit on the great breakthrough. He started talking to the man about the circulatory system and about blood, and he gradually came round every week to the fact that dead men don't bleed. And he was pleased as he saw his patient becoming more and more convinced of the fact that dead men don't bleed, although he still persisted in his belief that he himself was dead. So the great day of breakthrough came, which you may have begun to see. The psychiatrist seized his patient by the hand, but it concealed a needle in his hand which plunged into his finger, his patient's finger, and the blood began to well out. Now, said the psychiatrist, what do you say to that? The man looked at his finger, saw the blood, shook his head and said, dead men do bleed. A laughable story, but perhaps you see already the very real truth that that conveys. Our prejudice can make us utterly unwilling and therefore utterly unable to see the truth. Now, I do challenge you tonight, to what extent is your unbelief prejudice? To what extent is it really thought through and rational? Or to what extent is it something which has been built up irrationally all your life because of background and friends and experience outside and opening up to the facts which point to Christ and to truth? I believe the man who came to Jesus faced his unbelief. That's why he said, it's my unbelief. And I believe we must follow his example. We must come to Jesus admitting unbelief is a problem, a lot of which is rooted in our pride, our self-will, and our prejudice. And this means a humbling ourselves before God, which is a necessity before the personal relationship can be made with God, because only when we humble ourselves are we being honest about our problem, rooted in pride and prejudice. The other thing that this man did, which I believe we must also do, was that he came to Christ and looked at Christ. He took his eyes off himself and his unbelief, and he was now before Christ, looking to Christ, saying, help my unbelief. He was asking Christ for help. And that was why He made a breakthrough from unbelief to faith. We've looked at two stories in the New Testament tonight about men who came from unbelief to faith, and both of them looked at Christ. The first was probably a hard Roman centurion. I say hard because of the nature of his work, crucifixion included. And a man like that is never going to be soft and easily swayed. But as that man stood at the foot of the cross during this particular crucifixion, he experienced something quite unique. He experienced a man dying who, in his very death, in the things that he said and the way that he behaved, convinced the centurion that this was the Son of God. It's unclear to what extent he understood exactly what this meant. And he certainly didn't understand, as we now understand, what was happening on that cross. And yet, as he looked at it, faith began to grow in his heart. And as we look at the cross, faith can grow in our heart. We're in a far better position to see actually what happened now on the cross, because the Bible has made it clear. The resurrected Christ has made it clear what he was doing on the cross. He was taking human sin, human pride, human prejudice, all these things which had long separated man from God, and he was suffering the consequences, the guilt and the punishment that went with this rebellion of mankind against the Creator. And as we look at the cross and see a Christ who's dying for our pride, prejudice, and sin, I believe unbelief will begin to give way to faith. The second character we looked at was Thomas, one we've looked at before already in this church this year. As Thomas looked at Jesus, he too believed. But you say it was easy for Thomas. The real Christ appeared, resurrected from the dead, holes in his hands. It was easy. At one level it was. But in another level, I believe it was very hard for Thomas to actually kneel and say, "My Lord and my God." Thomas didn't really believe when he saw Christ. He believed when he knelt and said, "My Lord and my God." And that was why Jesus picked out Thomas as an example of those who've never seen yet believe. Because anyone can kneel and believe and say, "My Lord and my God," whether they see Christ or not. That is a position of faith, a position of commitment. And that is what Jesus sees as the right response to himself. And it's that response which leads to a total conviction that Christ is the Son of God. And it brings us the certainty, not only that he is that, but that he is alive. And we can know him. To make this fully real to us, God promises us that when we face our sin and unbelief for what it is, as pride and prejudice, when we look at the cross and see that he, Christ, was dying to take that guilt and punishment for our rebellion, when we kneel and say, "My Lord and my God," God will give us his Spirit. God will become personally involved with us. God's personality will indwell our personality. And that's how we come to conviction. That's how we forge this personal relationship, or rather how God forges this personal relationship with us, because we can't do it. God must make this personal relationship with us. He longs to do so, and he will do so when we kneel and believe. When we say, "I believe, help my unbelief." When we say, "My Lord and my God." So my challenge tonight is that we are willing to face not only the reasons for faith, but also the challenge to form or to receive a personal relationship with God through Christ, and that we will do so by confessing. It is our pride and self-will which is the basic thing that is holding us back from this personal commitment. As we confess that, will we at the same time look at Christ as the one who died for our sin and rebellion and pride, even though we may not fully understand that yet? And might we ask God to forge this personal relationship with himself by giving us his Spirit, the Spirit of the living, risen Christ. For some people, that may already have clicked, and you feel you're bursting almost to do that. I know at the last invitation service, we talked to some people like this who were literally bursting to forge that relationship with Christ. Others may still have queries and questions. In a moment, I will give a time to pray, so those who are bursting, as it were, to open up to God now and respond can do so. But for all of us, afterwards, as we stir around for coffee, which we hope as many people as possible will, there will be a chance to talk. Now let's talk seriously, especially if we are wanting matters cleared up. I, the other clergy, but everybody who is a Christian in church is available to talk, so we can clarify some of these matters. Talk over them together, and all move towards the point of real commitment, if we're so willing. If our doubts are genuine, I believe God will meet with us and help us. If it's pride and prejudice that are the root of our doubts, that this is the only barrier left, nothing will happen until we kneel and confess that this is the case, for that is the barrier. So let's now, either sitting or kneeling if you'd like to, be quiet before God, and then I will close after a moment of silence. So grant us all honest hearts, whether we are believers who still wrestle with doubts and yet know that you're real, whether we have just crossed that line from unbelief to faith, or whether we are still weighing up the claims and the challenge of your word. Grant us above all things honest hearts and a willingness to turn to you, who alone can settle our doubts intellectually, but also at every level of our being. Father, help us. Grant us a growing, burning faith. Amen.